Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Walt Harrington, sitting in for the vacationing Celeste Quinn. Today's guest is Neil Henry, who is a journalism professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of a brand new book, American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in the Age of New Media. Neil Henry is a former reporter for The Washington Post, both a local metropolitan reporter and a foreign correspondent who spent years covering issues and events in Africa. He is also author of a previous book, Pearl Secret. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you, Walt.
The book American Carnival, it is an interesting critique of journalism in its present state in America today, and it is also a book with some prescriptive advice about solutions for what you perceive as the issues that face us today. And it manages, I think, to be highly critical and at the same time highly hopeful. What is your take on the state of American journalism today?
I should say that I've been described by some people actually in a review not long ago as odd in that I'm an old-fashioned idealist about journalism, its traditional values, and its role in a free society. And when I say journalism, I mean professional journalism and the ethics that guide it, according to codes like the Society of Professional Journalists and the importance of values like being independent, minimizing harm, seeking truth, and reporting it. And these are sort of values that undergird what we consider sort of traditional mainstream media. And what I do in the book is describe why those values still mean something today in an age when so much is being transformed. But I try to do it in a way by being extraordinarily critical of many aspects of the mainstream press. And I do it by basically focusing on the economic challenge that new media is presenting to newspapers, local television stations, et cetera.
It also has a heavy dose of the impact that new media is having on the multiple access points for information and the idea, for instance, that in the future, everyone will be a journalist. Everyone will provide information, and people will be able to have access to an unlimited number of sources of information that the gatekeepers will have been dismissed from journalism, and the elitist component of journalism will be gone along with this new era of the free flow of information from so many different sources. How is all of that affecting journalism?
Well, I understand it. I mean, there's a lot of material in that supporting that view in my book, but there's also a strong belief I have that that's a very naive view, that anyone can be a journalist, that anyone can go out and do the reporting that we need in order to sustain ourselves as a free society. Just this week, for instance, there's a big story out here in the Bay Area with the old mainstay, the San Francisco Chronicle. Of course, it's been losing for over the last couple of years about $1 million a week under the Hearst Corporation due to the fact, of course, I mean, the old story that the paper can't really survive with declining advertising revenues, challenges by organizations like Craigslist.com that have undercut classified advertising. And while it's tried, like so many newspapers, to forge a presence on the web, its website, sfgate.com, it's one of the most heavily trafficked news sites in America. The fact is the money you can get from the web is paltry compared to traditional sources. So what does this mean? It means that the Chronicle just last week announced that they have to get rid of a quarter of their newsroom. You're talking over 100 reporters, editors, and other skilled professionals who do the work that I think the public takes for granted. And I mean things that bloggers don't do. I mean, they don't cover courthouses. They don't cover schools. They don't cover the cops. They don't do the sort of hard reporting that's done of hunting and gathering information that not only readers of a local newspaper rely on, but local radio stations and television stations and other media rely on to set news priorities. And the reason I wrote a piece in the not long ago about this, And it was kind of personal because some of these people who are endangered at the Chronicle are my former students who I've schooled over the last 15 years or so since I came to Berkeley in a lot of these traditional values, and they're losing their livelihoods, losing their jobs. And, you know, you're not going to find on YouTube or in the blogosphere or in these news aggregates like Google and Yahoo anything to replace the work that they did. So on the one hand, you have, I mean, the wonderful benefits that you outlined of what this future will be, of citizens contributing and a free flow of information back and forth, possibly enhancing our ability to communicate with each other. But that old-style journalism does mean something, and without it, I think we are somehow left as a society.
We're going to open this up in a few minutes to some phone calls. If our listeners are interested in asking you questions, I want to ask though, what is the solution to this challenge? It's obviously not just the San Francisco Chronicle. It's a challenge faced all across the country in what are called the old media. And do you have any ideas about how we're going to meet this challenge to continue to provide that percentage of journalism that we think of as quality journalism, as opposed to, you know, just the TV listings advice for the lovelorn.
Right. It's hard work, Walt. I mean, you know as well as I the challenge of doing excellent reporting is, and I think it is an ongoing struggle and not something that can easily be done. I think schools of journalism are going to play an increasingly important role in this, not only in schooling a new generation in all of the technical requirements of the digital age, but also in schooling in traditional values, how to do interviewing, how to research public records, how to communicate clearly. Schools of journalism will be, I think, even more important in the future. I also would like to think that, you know, and this is, I guess, I think it's probably extraordinarily controversial, but when you look at a corporation like Google, which has been so phenomenally important to our transformation in this information age, I would like to think that Google might be able to recognize what information science is doing to the tradition, the craft of journalism, and the sort of contraction of the news industry. And maybe Google might be able to take a kind of lead in offering ways to support journalism. And I don't necessarily mean financially. I just mean taking a lead in recognizing how computer science is challenging the practice of journalism.
Let me start out, but let me ask you, how good is the journalism being done in America today? The critics on the left and the right are constantly assaulting journalism for its failures. And your book probably is as good a source of the sad litany of frauds and failures that journalism has experienced and perpetuated in recent decades, long historically, frankly. But how good is journalism today compared to 10, 20, 50 years ago?
Good question. I think it's both better and in some ways worse. You're right. The litany of scandal, of fraud, is pretty long. In my book, for instance, explores various aspects of what I call the American carnival features of American journalism, which include a freak show, a funhouse, and a world of illusion. And we have so many frauds perpetrated by government and advertisers because the gatekeepers are falling down. We have fake news increasingly made by government officials and others in the guise of journalism in order to sell political viewpoints. We have frauds perpetrated by advertising industry, which peddles advertising in the guise of journalism. And of course, we have frauds that have led to the loss of many lives in Iraq, Afghanistan, due to the failures of the press, like from Judith Miller in the mainstream press.
Judith Miller of the New York Times, you're talking about in the coverage of the Iraq issues.
Exactly. Yet at the same time, I'd like to point out that there's some remarkable work being done. The Seymour Hersh, for instance, and the Abu Ghraib scandal of just a couple of years ago. This is the same Seymour Hersh who did the remarkable work during what some consider the golden age of journalism in the 60s and 70s when he uncovered the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. I think that was an extraordinary work of public service. Just two months ago, I think probably the best piece done this year was a two-part series done by the Washington Post by two reporters who spent 2 months at Walter Reed Hospital, a story you probably know about, where they uncovered the extraordinarily poor treatment that Iraqi veterans were receiving and the appalling conditions of this hospital. These were great heroes who had sacrificed a lot and came back to just abysmal treatment. Now, this piece by the Post was also something of a cautionary tale, I think, because when you consider the Post, the kind of risk they took in sending two reporters to Walter Reed for a period of 2 months and focusing exclusively on that story, and they spent probably upwards over $100,000 just in salaries and support for doing that story, not sure whether the story would come out, but they put their resources behind it, with that sort of idea that you never know exactly what profit good journalism will result in, but you sort of do it as a public service. And the Post did this piece, and I thought it was probably the most remarkable I've read this year. So I think it's both the best of times and in some ways the worst of times for journalism and its impact in society.
Let me give out our phone numbers here, Neil, for local callers who might want to ask you a question. It's 333-9455. For those outside our listening area, 1-800-222-9455. You go at some length on about the issues of failures of or fraud, let's say, by journalists who either have consciously lied or who are indifferent to traditional ideas about what is true and what is not. You in a time when many people question whether notions of truth are in any way relevant to our public conversation, and that issues of perspective are all that really is at issue, you go pretty strongly at the idea that accuracy and evidence of a very traditional nature, truth-telling in an old-fashioned sense, are still at the heart of the very finest of journalism. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. And the traditions are, you know, very long and deep. That is the sort of overarching credo in the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, which basically just seek truth and report it. And, of course, there are so many outstanding examples of failures in this regard, from Jason Blair at the New York Times, who was fired for fabricating a number of pieces during his time there. Jack Kelly at USA Today, who over a period of at least 10 years lied throughout many pieces in his coverage of the world, appealing to stereotypes about the way people behaved in places from Israel to Cuba to Nicaragua, and sort of appealing to American ideas about prejudice and stereotype, and surviving over a period of 10 years, thinking that he could get away with it. Eventually, he was caught. And we have today a kind of that is perhaps isn't new to the public or the listeners, of a feeling that, you know, if a story is good enough, whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter as long as it sells. And I write about the publishing industry, for instance, and James Frye and his memoir, I think it was a million little pieces, which is basically made an incredible amount of money based on his background as a drug addict and a survivor, one who overcame. But it was all a fib. And I would like to think that journalism plays a very important role in our society in honing in on what is true, so that we can decide as a people how to improve our lives. I mean, that's the purpose of,
line four
of
line
you know,
one.
In a free society. Okay. The truth will set you free. The truth is the answer. And I think we have to, in these shifting times, realize that journalism plays a role in that.
Neil, we have a call on line four. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, sir. I'm calling from Champaign.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about reporters and reporting in local or media like the Washington Post, it's always leaning towards a liberal bias. And although there is some good reporting, it seems like they want to focus on negative things against the establishment. And I know your guest there is from Berkeley, a notorious liberal educational facility. It seems like this is promoted through publications and opinions by newspapers and writers and media at large.
Well, thanks. I think we've got that. Neil, tell us about your outrageously left-wing point of view there in Berkeley.
You'd be surprised how conservative this place is, but I won't elaborate. I've lived in Berkeley for about 15 years, and I've met more classically conservative people here than anywhere else in the world. And I mean classically conservative in the sense that they do not want things to change, right? So if there is a kind of attitude about this place.
What about the liberal bias in the elite press, though, alleged?
I don't know what the terms mean anymore, really. I mean, we hear it all the time that there's liberal bias in the network, liberal bias in the mainstream press. I think holding people to account, officials who are elected officials and being watchdogs of government, and uncovering wrongs in society in order to improve people's lives, I don't know if that's liberal. I think it's more of a progressive attitude and one of the hallmarks of what journalism is about. I don't think I think liberal is the wrong word. Now, in fact, I think probably the most powerful media in the country today is probably Fox News, and I wouldn't consider that a liberal organization. It raised the sort of argument to a kind of marketing tool. In Fox News today isn't really reflective of solid journalism so much as argument and conservative cant and viewpoint.
You make an interesting point in American Carnival where you talk about the culture of a newsroom. Yours was the Washington Post. And the culture of that newsroom was one where everything was questioned, everything was treated skeptically, and there was an old rewrite man who said to you at one point, just because you believe something strongly doesn't mean you're right. And the constant process of questioning. Talk about that a bit, because yeah. I think I'm familiar with that myself, and I think it's very foreign to many non-journalists.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's in the conclusion of the book where I'm writing about the changes in the news industry and changes in the culture of journalism, and I'm writing from my perspective as a member of my admissions committee, looking at the new pool of applicants for our school. We're a two-year graduate program, master's degree program, and I'm reflecting on the number of people who are applying to our program with a sort of different view of what journalism is than it was a generation ago. A generation ago, there was an idea that of what a reporter was, what an editor was, what the purpose of news reporting was. And I had a number of people who are coming of age in the blogging generation, a kind of where you sort of comment and you reflect, you opine about the news, but that's not exact. That's not what reporting is, and that's not what real journalism is. And increasingly, the young people think that journalism is blogging. And I'm reflecting as I write about this, about my coming of age in the Post newsroom back in the late 1970s, 1980s, and coming to work as a young reporter, a night police reporter covering the city, not knowing very much about journalism, just hired as a summer intern. But my, what an extraordinary vehicle it was to learn about society, to learn about what made the city tick. I would go out at night from 7 until 4 o'clock in the morning hunting down police stories. An editor would tell me, go spend a night at the firehouse down in the ghetto and get to know life from the fireman's shoes if they saw it. And these experiences, whether it was the police, the fire, or covering schools, were extraordinary learning experiences. And you'd bring back your knowledge to the newsroom where it became a very much communal affair. You had, you had copy editors and you had editors overseeing you, and you'd write your work and then editors would question you about it, make sure of the accuracy of the spelling, make sure if it wasn't sourced enough to go out and find other sources to be as balanced as you could, knowing that ultimately your service was to the public, right? The truth you gave, that was your service to the story, giving the truth as you saw it to the public. And it was a place where your thinking was constantly being challenged, being challenged by others in the newsroom. The rewrite man you mentioned was a guy named Marty Weil, who is still there. He's an old-time police reporter who was also very helpful in the early days of the Watergate reporting. And I remember one night just sitting on the foreign desk before I went overseas to Africa, and I got incensed about something, and I can't remember exactly what it was, and I was talking to Marty about it. And Marty said, you know, it's natural and human to have a very strong reaction about things. But just because you feel strongly about something doesn't mean that you are right. And that process of thinking and rethinking things was important to I think, the development of, I think it's important to the development of real, true professional journalists that you do not find often in this new age of blogging, the solo laptop journalist, who doesn't have, is not able to take advantage of that kind of big communal intellectual enterprise that a newsroom can be.
Neil, we have another caller on line one. Line one, caller.
Hi, is this me?
It's you.
Oh, thank you.
I think.
I have an observation, and I have a bone to pick. It's just my personal belief as a newspaper lover. Now, I'm talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal-type newspapers. I love them. I can't do without them. I love them in paper, and I love them online.
Good for you.
And, you know, I cannot carry a laptop with me into the bathroom, on the bus. While I'm waiting in the doctor's office. Well, I suppose I could, but I'm not going to. And reading in an analog style as opposed to digital is much more interesting. My second observation, and this comes from cynicism because I've lived through, you know, Vietnam and Watergate and the My Lai massacre and all that, is let me refer you back to an incident when I believe this was in Lebanon. And they had captured, you know, so many of our U.S. citizens. And the camera showed the students outside with their flags and posters, and they were raising their fist in the air and chanting and shouting. And as it turned out later, of course, after the story had died down and the interest was, you know, sort of used up, it turned out that the CBS had rounded up these people and told them what to do and then filmed them. And the president of CBS did admit that on national TV. Now, if I have the network wrong, I do apologize. But
what's your question, caller?
My question is, my observation is, with behaviors of this type, it's difficult for the average reader, whether it's online, I'm not talking about people who read blogs, I'm talking about people who read newspapers, it's difficult for us to know what is not in there.
That's a good question. Neil, what about this?
I understand exactly. First off, the incident she described is certainly unethical. And any news organization that would contrive the news like that is wrong for doing so. The other point actually is in my mind about her notion about newspapers and the sort of tactile quality of newspapers that are very portable. I was thinking about that not long. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and she is very much of this age. She is a person who is Web 2.0 and into MySpace and Facebook and cell phone text messaging, et cetera, and lives a virtual world that is really quite remarkable. Now, she's the daughter of somebody who is, you know, I have 30 years in journalism and also I teach journalism. I have newspapers all around the house and magazines all around the house. She doesn't touch them. She is on her laptop at all times and on her cell phone, where she also gets information. I think The point that the caller was making is that she's exactly right that newspapers do have that sort of quality, just like books do, in an age when print press all across the land are sort of under threat. But the fact is that a new generation is coming along and does not think very highly of that. And so I think print in general is endangered in coming decades.
Let's imagine who would gain the most if we were someday to live in a world without the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, or even without the local Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. Who would win in that situation?
Well, gee whiz, I think the entrenched power in the land would certainly win. If you don't have a critical media dedicated to holding people to account and investigating shortcomings in our systems of in the judiciary, in the legislature, in the executive branches, entrenched power, both politically and economically, would certainly be victorious in this country.
Well, let me ask you: there is a constant drumbeat on the left and the right about the criticisms of the so-called mainstream press. How do you think that constant drumbeat of criticism from the I won't call them extremes, but from those points of view, how does it affect quality journalism in the United States?
That's a good question, Walt. I think there's some of this I write about in the book about what the criticism of the media is doing to the vitality of the media. For instance, there are a number of papers, television stations that are so leery and afraid of alienating the public that they perhaps don't take chances that they once did. Back in the day I was at the Washington Post, extraordinary means were called for to report stories, they were willing to take a chance. And that's why during two projects at the Post, I was allowed to go undercover to write about the lives of the destitute in Washington and also the lives of migrant workers in North Carolina. These were undercover projects at a time when the Post was feeling extraordinarily strong after the Watergate years and willing to take chances in order for that pursuit of the truth.
You mean because there would be criticism of the fact that you did not identify yourself as a reporter?
Exactly, which is considered in most areas of the business. I mean, it's unethical to not reveal yourself as a reporter. But for these two stories, I determined, with support from my editors, that I really couldn't get the story well if I had to, if I didn't pursue it that way.
And both of the stories, if I remember correctly, had enormous impact and reach when they came out as series, right?
Yeah, they did. And I thought the means. I thought it was important to do the story that way. You don't find nowadays newspapers and the press taking chances like that because of fears of alienating the public, lowering ethical standards, feeling that that protecting those ethical values are very, very important. Goes also into the criticism that the press, like our caller earlier said, that the press is liberal. There is, I find in a lot of newsrooms, a fear of being perceived as liberal, which means there's a kind of weakness sometimes in reporting or in a bend-over backwards quality to make sure you get conservative or what are perceived as the conservative viewpoints on record. And so I do think this criticism, public criticism of the press, does have an effect on how the press covers the news.
Neil, we've got a caller on line two.
Yeah. Hi. Good afternoon. One of the things that kind of bugs me about this discourse about media criticism is sort of a false equivalence that's given between the criticism of the left and the criticism of the right. And essentially, the right, from what I can tell, gets really frustrated when journalists point out kind of unpleasant facts about the way that things work. And largely, the criticism that I've been able to tell, and I'm a participant in this discussion online, from the left is that, we really just want journalists to ask more and more hard questions. We don't want them to stop being journalists. And I don't think most people on, in the left blogosphere want believe that they're going to take over journalism. They just kind of want them to do their job more than they are perceiving that that's not what's happening. So I'll hang up and take my answer offline. But that's I don't think we're well served if we think there's some kind of false equivalence between these two criticisms, because I don't think that there is.
Thanks, Neil.
No, I think he's right. That's one really good thing about I think the blogosphere and the millions of voices that are taking part in the blogosphere. I personally don't think the greatest value of it is as a source so far of great original reporting, original news gathering in the blogosphere. But it's how the blogosphere pushes journalists to be better and also provides perhaps sources for new information. I agree with him that it's not mutually exclusive. I don't think that the growth, the emergence, the burgeoning impact of the blogosphere on the exchange of information in society necessarily translates into the shrinkage of journalism. Because in fact, I do believe that the push is for journalists to do their jobs better.
We have a caller on line three.
Yes. Just getting back to what you've just been talking about, it just seems to me that with all the consolidation in the media, more and more outlets for news are being put in the hands of the corporate interests and really the big boys that are consolidating their hold. And how are you going to get a divergence of opinion? That's one of the reasons why I listen, read the blogs as much as possible, because I'm just not hearing it from the media. I see, when I'm watching television, I see a lot more coverage being given to conservative point of views and a lot less coverage, if any at all, being given to the liberal sources. And when questions need to be asked of those in power, they're usually softballs, and it just sort of like comes out that people are giving their opinions and not actual news.
Neil?
You make very good points. In my book, I write about a consulting firm for local television news operations called Magid. Frank Magid, the organization is a big one in American society. They help advise local television news stations about what kinds of news coverage will translate into better ratings, and what sort of style of sets to use in order to capture attention. And during the run-up to the Iraq War, this consultancy put out a report to select television stations around the country that if they focused on too much on demonstrations and protests against the war, they were in danger of losing audience share because of the sort of tenor of the time. And some critics pointed to that as an example of how local television stations decided not to give the full story because they didn't want to lose market share. He's also right about the consolidation of the media and the shrinkage in voices. Right now, there is the big story of Rupert Murdoch possibly about to take over the Wall Street Journal. And the problem with this for a lot of critics is that Murdoch and all that he represents, this gigantic media corporation with tentacles around the world, now will have possibly his hands on the most distinguished and important business newspaper in the United States. And what will that mean? Well, Murdoch is saying so far in sweet talking for The Offer that he will not involve himself in the editorial processes at the newspaper, but in fact, his example has always been too metal to the extent whether it's the New York Post or given the his newspaper's reach, including the Times of London, he meddles to the extent of preventing reporters and editors from doing critical stories on China because of his desire to build close relations with China. So this is just an example of this continuing process of consolidation. And the answer, of course, if he goes to the blogosphere to find alternative voices, that's an excellent place to start.
Do you have a follow-up caller?
Yeah. Most people don't go to the blogs. Most people are still getting their information from the major media outlets, primarily television. And that's really slanted, towards the right. the people that are interviewing the administration and people in power in Washington are afraid to ask the hard questions because they're going to lose access. And there's no critical critical questioning of what's going on. And
I agree. I think that question of access, in fact, was I don't know if you saw the Bill Moyers report about a month or so ago on exploring how the media failed the United States during the run-up to the Iraq War. And part of his explanation in his reporting was that, and it's also reflected somewhat in my book, is that this desire for access, of being close to power centers in Washington, was the main obstacle to actually getting at the truth of the story from the weapons of mass destruction and other aspects of the story in the run-up to the Iraq War. And the one area of the press he did which compliment were those organizations in Washington, those newspapers that represented not so much, were not interested in cozying up to the power centers, but were interested in reporting to their readers in a lot of these towns across America where some of the soldiers would be coming from to fight that war. And so that's where a lot of the most critical reporting came from, is where the reporters who thought about writing for the families in those communities where the soldiers were coming from.
Neil, let me ask, some of this argument, of course, is based on sort of what we're comparing our era to. You know, we do have Fox today, for instance, from a conservative perspective. MSNBC, some people say, has become consciously more liberal-oriented in response to the ratings war with Fox. These outlets did not exist only a handful of years ago. And so when it comes to on television, the idea that there is less diverse point of view, when we go back to the era of Walter Cronkite and three networks, are we more or are we less diverse today?
I think we are. I don't think it's a... You know what I think, Walt? I don't think it's a matter of diversity. I think we have less impactful, meaningful journalism, period. It's not a matter of different voices. It's just less solid journalism. I think the impact of Fox News has been most pronounced on television, not in its, I don't think, in its conservative framework toward what it reports, but in the fact that it's all argument. It's all... opinion, most of it. I mean, it's opinion, it's argument, which is replacing journalism. You know, and these are the opinions are real cheap. Journalism is expensive, and we see it reflected also. You know, so if MSNBC, you also have more argument, even though it's argument from a different side. But the sum total is that all of this time, space, and arguing is taking the place of what could be, you know, solid journalism. I mean, what's the guy on 60 Minutes, the old guy, what's his name? Andy Rooney?
Right.
You know, when CBS made the big decision to hire Katie Couric a year and a half, 2 years ago, I can't remember how long it was, he made an interesting point, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that, you know, for the salary that they were going to pay her, which was at that time considered to be about $25 million a year to be a reader of the news, that could translate into 100, you know, solid newspaper, news reporters, television news reporters and correspondents, you know, anywhere in the world, and which would add information to the public knowledge of what we need to know. And he was criticized and put down by CBS executives, but he made it a valid point. For that's an extraordinary amount of money to pay someone to read the news and to pay someone for her Q rating. But you know the trade off is you don't have those reporters actually going out reporting, and it's symbolic of the sort of retrenchment of journalism as we know it. I mean, when I was in Africa between 1989 and 1992, there were network presences in Africa. I would travel around the continent and find CBS reporters, ABC reporters, CNN. Newspapers were represented in a lot of bureaus in Nairobi, South Africa, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire. Nowadays, I mean, just barely 15 years later, the networks are nowhere in Africa. The networks are, they cover Africa when they can, when they think news requires it, from London or Paris. Newspapers that once were represented are no longer there anymore. And so it's quite a, it's an extraordinary contradiction we are seeing, in that we have incredible new means of technology and ways of learning about each other and learning about the world, yet at the same time it's in extraordinary retrenchment, at least in professional journalism.
So do you see any solutions to this problem of who is going to pay for the cost of doing quality journalism?
I kind of think ultimately, we talk about this at the school a lot on the faculty, that ultimately we may be heading toward a model protecting professional journalism that is sort of on the BBC model in London, which is supported by public money. And so maybe radios like stations like yours, NPR, PBS, maybe these are the ultimate protectors of professional journalism as we know it, that should be sustained more solidly in the future.
And, of course, those are without politics.
Yeah, good one.
Yeah. Well, you know, you do raise a fascinating larger point in the book, too, about the issue of how today the issue of truth seems to have been devalued. And more people seem to believe that there really isn't any such thing as truth. And you use the book publishing industry as your example, a million little pieces, and you could cite a million other examples where the marketplace defines what is marketable, not whether or not it's accurate or not. What is it about this frame of reference, this mindset, that is so so potentially dangerous to our very notion of being able to gather the information we need to make real decisions?
Well, I think it's self-evident. If truth is something that is just so incredibly fungible, it leaves us at risk of all kinds of wrongs. I mean, as the recent past has shown us, and it's the problem of adhering to values like the truth in journalism is also certainly important to the book publishing industry, and yet we don't see as fully and completely as we should crackdowns on trends that would undermine that. We have, for instance, at NBC right now, the sort of a small point, but a guy named Rick Kaplan is in charge of trying to fix the ratings. It's either NBC or CBS, I'm not sure which.
I should point out that Rick is an alumni of the University of Illinois and is an adjunct faculty member here.
Okay, well,
in the Department of Journalism.
Sorry to make
that's okay. Go ahead. He can take it.
Some years ago, Cokie Roberts, he was the producer of the news, and Cokie Roberts was covering Congress, and they were in the newsroom, and they had a couple of minutes in order to try to get a report on the air. Mr. Kaplan, if this is the same Rick Kaplan, said it would be much more impactful if they sold it that she was at the Capitol building and not in the newsroom. And so he put her in a fur coat, and put her in front of a picture of the Capitol, and because it was a cold winter night, and there she was in the hot newsroom wearing a fur coat in front of a picture of the Capitol, and she reported as if she was from there. And the purpose being to sort of perhaps enhance the credibility, enhance the urgency. In the end, once it was revealed, they were terribly apologetic, et cetera. But of course, they have maintained their reputations in the business, while others, of course, like Jason Blair and Jack Kelly, were outed and routed out of the business. And so, you know, some frauds are okay, evidently, and some frauds are not.
Well, let's hope it's a matter of degree.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Neil, listen, it's been really great to have you with us today. Some thoughtful conversations, some thoughtful phone calls, and good luck with the American Carnival. It is truly an important book.
Thanks. Nice talking to you, Walt.
Thank you, Neil.